Coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. Attracting talent to the First State workforce is a key component of economic development, but sometimes it can be problematic.
College graduates just don't consider Delaware to be quite as cool a place to live as, say, Philadelphia or New York, Baltimore or Washington. And they don't seem to label Delaware as a great place to launch their careers.
Contributor Larry Nagengast examines a new effort to build the state's base of entry-level professionals. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also have an interview from our collaboration with the Delaware State News, Building Bridges, conversations with Delawareans working in the community on social justice and furthering racial equity. And we bring you the latest edition of the Delaware Humanities podcast, A Matter of Facts. It's all next on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We start the show with another piece in our latest collaboration with the Delaware State News, Building Bridges, conversations with Delawareans working in the community on social justice and furthering racial equality. Police violence has come under renewed scrutiny this year as the result of nationwide protests sparked by the killing of George Floyd. Delaware has had its own police killings. Perhaps most well-known is the 2015 shooting of wheelchair user Jeremy McDowell by four Wilmington police officers. Nearly 5 years after the incident, Jeremy's sister, Keandra, has redoubled her calls for the officers to be charged. She's led several rallies this summer in an attempt to pressure justice officials to reopen their investigation. In this Building Bridges conversation, Delaware Public Media's Sophia Schmidt talks with Wilmington resident and activist Keandra McDowell about her journey seeking justice for her brother and systemic change.
How did you get into police reform activism?
September 23rd, 2015, when my brother was shot and murdered. I couldn't just sit down idly and not do anything. I couldn't just sit down and do nothing. This is my brother, you know. And then after months went on, I'm like, hold on. Actually, this is bigger than Jeremy. Like, this is way bigger than him. If you stand up and fight now, you're fighting for all of us, not just you. You're fighting for other people's family members. You got to get out there and do something. You can't just sit there, Kiki. You have to do something. So ever since then, I was working two jobs and going to school at the time down in Rehoboth for automotive technician. I gave up everything to come up here to move with my family and fight for my brother.
To the extent you want to, would you tell me a little bit about your brother? What kind of a person he was? What do you remember most about him?
What I remember most about him and what everybody remembers about him is his smile. He had this glowing smile with nothing but teeth when you seen him. He always smiling. Just because he was in a wheelchair, he wasn't born in a wheelchair. He got shot back when he was 18. One of his friends had shot him in the back six times out of jealousy. He was just a upbeat person. He loved kids. Every morning he had this routine where he would come pick up my nephew and take him to the corner store every morning to get a blue water ice. Like, my nephew would sit on the porch and wait for him. He would put the kids on his wheelchair and make go-kart noises, like he riding them around on the go-kart. All the kids knew when Uncle Bam Bam come or Mr. Bam Bam come, he got candy in his pocket. He got candy in his book bag. He gonna give us candy. So they all swarmed around him. Hey, Bam Bam was a people person. He attracted people. So he was just a good person. I'm not saying that my brother was an angel. He definitely wasn't no angel. Nobody's an angel. Nobody's perfect. He was just an ongoing person.
So obviously your brother's death is the, like, biggest experience in your life that's shaped how you see police and law enforcement. Are there other experiences that have shaped the activism that you do?
Before even my brother got murdered, they harassed my brother. I remember one time where he had got locked up on Rodney Street. He had like three bags of weed on him, and he got locked up. We're thinking they're taking him to the downtown to bring charges on him. No, we get a phone call where we just seen a cop put Bam Bam out on the streets in front of Byard School. So we turn around from going to the police station to go up there to Byard School. They put my brother on the sidewalk in front of Byard School and put his wheelchair to the other end of the corner and told him to go get his wheelchair the best that he can, and told us, looked over at us and told us that we better not go get his wheelchair. It's been a lot. I never I never cared too much for police in general, you know, because I live in the inner city. We see a lot of stuff in the inner city. We see harassment and everything else. But what happened to my brother is what made me, like, go in the streets actually and show my face and protests and marches. People think that I'm not shy and, like, don't mind being in front of the camera. I am shy and I don't like the camera. But ever since everything happened to my brother, I had to put that to the back of my mind and do what I needed to do to protect him and anybody else in the future.
So your family, as you mentioned, has been working on this since it happened. You've been calling for change to the use of force law. There was, you know, a settlement with the city. Would you mind kind of summarizing that path of trying to get justice for your brother? And sort of what is your strategy now?
Okay, so part of the lawsuit was that Wilmington police come up with a de-escalation policy so that anybody with mental health, anybody like that was in my brother's situation or so forth, that they handle the situation differently so nobody else gets shot 16 times. We did speak to them one time, the Wilmington police and a couple other people in the Wilmington police district or whatever, the person who does the training and this and the third was in a meeting, and they said that they were using my brother's situation in training, and they claimed that a certain amount of hours had to be with retraining the police every year. They had to go through a certain amount of hours or whatever, but honestly, I haven't heard anything else about it. Nobody, since Chief Tracy, I believe his name, took his position, we have never met him. I don't know, honestly, if they're doing that or not. I don't know. Heck, for all I know, they can be using my brother's picture at the shooting range to practice shooting. I don't know. So we get asked that a lot. Do they like correspond transparency? No, we haven't heard anything from the police station since the lawsuit. And I don't believe that we will.
So you've hosted rallies, you know, through the years. You've met with people. I know this summer you've hosted a couple more rallies. And would you say that they've gotten more, you know, more attendance, more attention because of the moment that we're in this country?
So my issue, I believe, with getting people out to support us, somewhat I believe it is that my protests always be on, is always on a weekday. The reason why I do them on a weekday, because I feel as though that's when everybody is in the buildings where we're going to, the city council building, the attorney general building, the police station, everybody is there. I feel like if we do it on a weekend, the attorney general is not there, the city council members are not there. So this Saturday, July 11th at 11 o'clock, we do have another protest that I made on a Saturday because everybody were telling me, can you please just do one on a weekend? So I do believe that every protest that we had gets a little bigger each time, a little bigger each time. And it's different faces that I don't even know. So I am seeing on this one, I did reach out for outside help this time from Philadelphia, from New Jersey, Virginia, Maryland, and Philly. I feel as though that we need outside help. We can't do this by ourselves. So it's time for us to just reach out for us outside help and see if they can help us. See, with situations, cases like my brother, police involved shootings, the government, everybody in that state, wherever it happens at, they know that's a time limit. They know that black people, they'll fight for stuff for a little bit, and then eventually they let it die out. Everybody stops. They count on that. They count on people to do that. You know, so I notice in other states, they're not doing that. They're fighting every day. They're marching and protesting every day. Somebody is doing something to help that family at least once a day. So I think that by asking for outside help, that it will actually help people here come out and support as well.
So does the national attention around police violence, the energy around police reform, and in some cases, abolition or defunding the police, do you feel like this is creating an environment that might lead to actual change on your brother's case? Does this moment feel different, you know, as someone who's been working on this for years?
This moment does feel different. This is something that's going to go down in history, you know, because in Delaware, I mean, look at what happened with the looting and the rioting just last month or a little bit over a month ago. That's when Delaware woke up. They woke up. You know, when you start going and start digging in their pockets, you know, that's what they don't like. You could protest, you could march and everything else, but if you start affecting their money, that's a problem. defunding the police. I believe that in cases like my brother, police-involved shootings, that the money shouldn't come from taxpayers. The money shouldn't come from stuff. It should come from the police officer. Or if the FOP want to keep backing these cops up, it should come from their funding then. And I believe by doing that, that will give them a chance when they're in situations with, you know, with situations like my brother, in cases like my brother, police brutality, I believe that would give them a chance to stop and think for a second. To know that, hold up, if I shoot this person, you know, I can go broke. For real. I can, there's consequences. Right now, there's no accountability for these officers that are just going out and killing people. Especially in Delaware, I believe Chris Barish did a story where he found out that it was like 52 cases of police-involved shootings since 2005. And out of them cases, no officer has ever been held accountable for anything, not even a little bit of accountability. So I believe, yeah, defunding the police, I support that.
So of the many different, reform proposals or things even kind of ranging beyond criminal justice that people are pushing for right now, what are your priorities?
My priorities have to be here in Delaware at the time, because I feel as though, like, we can go to the U.S. Attorney General's, but we need to remove that one law, because anything else that we do, if that law is not changed with the police just being justified because they say they feel threatened for their life, anything that we do here in Delaware means nothing. It means nothing. It still justifies the police killing somebody and getting away with it.
And just to clarify, you're speaking about the use of force.
The use of force, yes.
Justifications.
Yes, the only thing an officer has to say or state is that they feel threatened for their life. Just by them saying that, it clears them of any wrongdoing that they do. It doesn't matter if it's video footage. It doesn't matter if it's witnesses. It doesn't matter if the attorney general states that something needs to be done. This officer needs to be charged. It does not matter. With that law being put in place, it still clears them.
So I know that Kathy Jennings, the attorney general, she has said that she wants to see that law changed. Now, she's obviously not a legislator. There is some support amongst legislators to clarify or change that law, but we haven't seen it done yet. Are you speaking with legislators on this? Do you feel that there is willingness in Delaware, or like, where's the pushback going to come from if such legislation comes before the General Assembly?
I haven't spoke to anybody in the legislative. I know that the NAACP is. I know that the Black Caucus is. They are pushing for it. There are people there who are pushing for it. And they are using my brother's situation as a good example of why this needs to happen. I'm all in. So if I can get involved in it, of course I want to be involved in it. That's number one priority for me.
Anything else that you wanted to add that I'm missing?
I've released photos of his body on social media. It took me years to do that. Years to do that. And I had to go back and forth with my family about it because we didn't want to put it out. You know, that's personal. But we needed people to feel what my brother felt that day. We needed people to feel what we feel every day. We needed people to see what we close, when we close our eyes, what we see, the last thing that we see of my brother. You know, people say try to remember the good memories. It's hard remembering the good memories of something like this. You know, I have nightmares. My mom has nightmares. My mom is mentally, like, messed up behind all this. Our kids even know, watch the video. Because, you know, kids on YouTube, they even seen the video of what happened to my brother. Not by us showing it to them, but just by them finding it, running across it. Like, it tore my family up. My grandma at the scene, she went up to the scene and she seen my brother's feet hanging out of the white sheet. And she had a heart attack at the scene. They had to rush her to the hospital that day. They had his body out there for, I'm thinking it's 3 hours and 47 minutes. No, it was 4.5 hours. They had his body laying on the ground. They had took all his clothes off of him. I still don't understand that. After him laying down on the ground for 3 hours, you know he's dead. What was the point of taking his clothes off of him? They said he had a gun. Now, when he fell out the wheelchair, a gun is heavy. With the way he fell out the wheelchair, he felt like kind of crooked, like back a little bit. The gun is heavy. The gun would have automatically fell. Bloop. You would have heard it in the video. Like, I just, it's a long fight. It is.
Thanks, Sophia. And stay with us. The Green continues in a moment with a look at a new program launched this summer that is trying to attract more entry-level professionals into Delaware's workforce. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. Economic development efforts in Delaware often focus on bringing new businesses to the First State. But attracting a workforce is also important, and a new effort to do that is getting started this summer. It's called Intern Delaware and is focused on building the pool of entry-level professionals in the state. Contributor Larry Nagengast offers a look at this effort in his latest piece at DelawarePublic.org, and he joined me this week to tell us more about it. So Intern Delaware is looking to solve this issue of attracting young entry-level talent to the First State workforce. And I guess the questions right off the bat are, you know, who is this targeting, and what are the issues with getting that kind of talent here in the First State?
Well, you know, whether it's banking or accounting, insurance, biotech, pharmaceuticals, just about every type of business brings on college interns during the summer. And, you know, it's a way to for the businesses to identify talent while filling some of those gaps in the office during those months when the full-time employees are more likely to be using their vacation time. You know, and, you know, the prime targets for Intern Delaware are college students who are going to college in-state, because more than two-thirds of this group take their first jobs after graduation out of state. So two-thirds of the, you know, graduates of the UD, Wilmington University, Delaware State, so on, are heading to somewhere else after they graduate. Then the secondary target here are those students who attend colleges out of state but come to Delaware for summer internships. So now there are two key issues that Intern Delaware is trying to address. One is that college graduates just don't consider Delaware to be quite as cool a place to live as, say, Philadelphia or New York, Baltimore or Washington. And the other corollary to this is that they don't seem to label Delaware as a great place to launch their careers.
So your piece notes that nearly two dozen local companies signed on for this first year of the program. Can you give us a sense of who they are and why they see the need for this beyond kind of the internship programs and recruitment efforts they're already doing on their own?
Well, you know, you've got the big names. You've got Capital One, DuPont, Chemours, Wisvis Bank, M&T, CSC, and then you've got some smaller companies that have a significant local and regional impact, Agilent, Adesis, Pacini Poland, Compass Red, even the Big Fish Restaurant Group. Now, the motivation here is a feeling that as a group, they can do more than they might do on their own. I'm going to give you a couple of, you know, quick examples like that. If you want your interns to meet a government leader, the mayor, the governor, they're more likely to make the time to meet with you if you've got an audience of 100 young people rather than just a handful. Also, interns are probably more likely to go to an art museum with a group of their peers than to go by themselves. And, you know, from the business side, you know, why should 20 different human resources offices be arranging all these intern activities if you've got a willing third party that's interested in handling this sort of thing for all of them? But, you know, the underlying theme beneath all of this is that, you know, the more comfortable interns feel while they're working during the summer in Delaware, the more likely they are to start their careers here.
So let's get to the nitty-gritty a little bit here. What's kind of the basic outline of how this program is supposed to work?
Well, I think some of the things I just mentioned give you a couple of hints here, but the overarching idea was to enhance what individual businesses do to make their own interns feel at home by arranging unique experiences that would enable the interns to see more of the state, to interact with each other, and to see the interrelationships that exist among the state's businesses. So the original plan included bringing interns together at events like music and ethnic festivals, show them historic sites, introduce them to the Grand, the riverfront, the art museums, things like that. And also with setting up some sessions that would introduce them to the state's business and government leaders so they would get some exposure beyond the workplace where they have their day jobs for the summer.
So like with everything else, the COVID-19 pandemic kind of up ended the apple cart in terms of what you can and can't do. How did this program have to adjust to this kind of new normal with the COVID-19 pandemic?
Well, and early in the year, and you know, and when I first learned about Intern Delaware in February or so, the businesses were expecting to hire, the businesses that are participating in this program were expecting to hire somewhere in the order of 350 interns for the summer. Then March came along, the state shut down, businesses adjusted their thinking, and the intern count at these participating companies dwindled to about 150. Now, many of the interns, like regular employees, were also working remotely. So as a result, the activities that had a social or a network component just haven't happened. The meetups with government and business leaders have gone virtual. So they've been working with video conferences held on Thursday afternoons. And featured guests have included Governor Carney, Wilmington Mayor Mike Perzicki, a group of CEOs, entrepreneur Ben DuPont, and a group of up-and-coming business leaders. So they're making the connection, but the connections are being made virtually. So it takes a little bit of luster off it, but it's still happening.
With that in mind, you had a chance to chat with some of the interns involved. What have their experiences been like?
Well, you know, it's not quite what they expected, but all in all, that's really not a bad thing. The interns I spoke to all seem to like the work that they're doing for the companies that have hired them for the summer. They feel that they're making an impact in these jobs. They do miss having the face-to-face contact that they had anticipated, both in their workplaces and with their fellow interns. But they have been impressed with those Thursday afternoon sessions, seeing how accessible some of the state's most influential citizens are, and taking to heart some of the suggestions that those leaders have offered to them.
So broadly speaking, does it seem like it's having the impact those behind it had hoped for? Are some of these interns maybe looking closer at Delaware as a place to start work when they graduate?
Well, I think the Intern Delaware's organizers are satisfied with how the program has proceeded thus far. They weren't quite sure how they were going to pivot to this largely virtual programming, but that really hasn't been a problem thus far. Like everyone else for the past few months, I'm sure they would have preferred more face-to-face interaction and more opportunities to show off the state to these interns. Even so, the interns who live in Delaware that I did interview say that they've learned more about the state and the opportunities it provides for young professionals. And one Maryland resident who has been fortunate enough to work on site for CSC says he has seen enough of Delaware to believe that he could be comfortable here if he gets a job offer. I mean, this is a small sample size, I know, and probably a half dozen or so students that I talked to. But it does suggest that under better circumstances, this program does have plenty of potential.
On the other side of that coin, how about the companies themselves? It's probably a little bit more limited, as you said, than they'd hope, but do they seem to be getting value out of this first year and kind of getting a sense for what this program, as you said, the potential it might have?
Yeah, well, again, there are fewer interns than anticipated, so the impact overall is probably not as great as anyone had hoped for. But there's no denying that the program has expanded on the perks that the individual businesses can offer their interns. So they certainly see that the interns are getting more out of this program than they would have if this was just an intern program limited to a single company.
So I'm curious, does it feel like this program is better suited for larger companies or smaller ones? I know it may be tough to tell from this first year, but is there a sense who might benefit more?
Well, you know, I mean, it works for companies of all sizes, no doubt about that. But I would think there's probably an even greater return for the smaller ones. See, because the smaller companies are less likely to have the resources to organize events of the magnitude that Intern Delaware has envisioned and has created. You know, if you've got two or three employees, you're just not going to be able to do or try to do some of the bigger type events. You know, and now with the pandemic and so many people working remotely, one thing that has been difficult to achieve is to get those interns out of their individual corporate silos. I mean, unless they know each other already, an intern who's working remotely at for CSC, for example, isn't likely to interact much with one who is working remotely for WSFS or M&T or Capital One. So that's something that, you know, it's probably going to get better in the future, but this year it's been a little bit difficult to achieve. Now, of course, you know, one potential benefit for Intern Delaware is that interns in a more normal setting would have a chance to find out more about companies other than the one that they're working for. And that way they would learn about more potential opportunities with different companies. And the more they know, of course, about the state, the more likely they are to consider Delaware and Delaware as an entity rather than a single business as the place to start their careers.
So that network piece, it's really kind of crucial to this thing having the maximum impact going forward.
Most definitely. I mean, there was even some talk early on within Intern Delaware that they might be able to create situations where an intern might spend a portion of the summer with one company and then move on over to another. Now, that idea didn't float so well with some of the participants this year, but it's certainly something that's on the table for the next cycle. So that, yeah, there's a lot of talk here about wanting to be able to do more, give students greater exposure to the state and to the diversity within the business community as well.
And I suppose, you know, this last question may be a little bit hard to answer after year one under these type of conditions, but is it likely that this program is going to lead to job offers, or maybe is that not entirely the point here? I mean, I'm sure for the students it is.
The students are, yeah, certainly, yeah, they, you know, they're looking to land a job for a year or two when they graduate. Now, the companies that I spoke with, they all say that they've had good success in recent years in their as they've converted interns into full-time employees. So, you know, I wouldn't say that Intern Delaware of itself is going to make it more likely that an intern is going to get a job offer, but I would say that Intern Delaware could be the deal clincher. It's a special program that increases the likelihood that the intern is going to accept the job offer because the intern is more likely to see that Delaware is a desirable place to be. And now what's more important, though, and I did hear this from a couple of different businesses, is Intern Delaware going to motivate young professionals to establish their roots here more firmly and more quickly than they have in the past, so that not only when they take the first job, but after two or three years down the road, they want to stay here rather than move somewhere to north or south on the I-95 corridor? That's going to be the real telling factor here. Not only are the businesses able to hire interns, but whether they're going to be able to hang on to them and have them make their careers here.
Thanks to contributor Larry Nagengast for his time on The Green this week. You can read his reporting on the Intern Delaware program at delawarepublic.org. And stay with us. We wrap up the show with the latest edition of the Delaware Humanities podcast, A Matter of Facts. This episode looks at the crisis in local news and ways to get more investigative and accountability reporting into communities. That's next on The Green, here on Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. This week we bring you the latest installment of the Delaware Humanities podcast, A Matter of Facts. The podcast delves into identifying trustworthy and reliable sources of news and information as part of Delaware Humanities' mission to engage, educate, and inspire all Delawareans through cultural programming. This season, the podcast more closely examines popular sources of news and information. And in this episode, the focus is local news, with perhaps a little less emphasis on if it's a reliable source and more on if it's simply available. And if it isn't, what does that mean for the local communities they serve? We discuss those issues with ProPublica's Deputy Managing Editor, Charlie Ornstein, who oversees ProPublica's local reporting network, which works with local news sources on accountability journalism. Here is the A Matter of Facts podcast. Charlie Ornstein, thanks so much for joining us on the A Matter of Facts podcast.
Thanks for having me.
First, I do want to talk a little bit about your career. You've done a tremendous amount of investigative work. Won a Pulitzer Prize for the Los Angeles Times piece investigating the Drew King Medical Center in Los Angeles. I'm curious how that work has informed your view of local journalism and its importance.
Yeah, I was fortunate enough to get my start in local journalism. I started by covering two Dallas suburbs, Garland and Mesquite, Texas, and spent the first year of my journalism career working from those suburbs and trying to understand the way local government works, the way city councils work, how what decisions are made at the local level affect local citizens, and when things go wrong, who pays the price for that. So it gave me a really firm appreciation of just how central local government is, not just in big cities, but also, you know, in suburbs and small towns.
And with that as a foundation, I mean, there are a number of issues that really are plaguing local news at this time, whether it be print, broadcast, or online entities. The biggest and perhaps the most basic is that there just are fewer outlets in many places now, and the ones that are there have smaller staffs. In some places, we're seeing that kind of start to develop news deserts. And I guess my question for you is are we kind of reaching a crisis level with this? And given the economics and the COVID-19 pandemic, can it be turned around?
Well, I feel like we're beyond a crisis moment. We were in a crisis moment years ago, and it's only been accelerated by what is happening right now as you and I speak. And so I'm deeply, deeply concerned about this, that many, many important issues aren't getting the coverage they need. When you see local reporters who are being asked to cover City Hall and the schools and the courts and transportation, or maybe for multiple towns, there's no possible way you can be the eyes and ears on all of these things. And so important stories, important accountability stories, aren't getting the attention they need. And when that happens, I feel people in power sometimes know that and feed off that and are willing to take risks that they wouldn't take if they knew that a reporter was watching what they were doing. And so it is a huge threat to our democracy, frankly. It's not just to any particular news organization, but I think it has widespread effects that really go beyond that. It's not a hopeless situation, to your point. It is definitely a crisis, but I think ProPublica and other news organizations are trying to identify opportunities to help ensure that accountability journalism remains a potent force at the local level by providing not only money, but also the help and support to get those important stories out to a local audience and also to a national audience.
And I'm interested because, I mean, in addition to just kind of stretching reporters and staffs kind of thin and having them covering multiple things simultaneously, I mean, historically, it's these local outlets, as you kind of pointed out, that dig in and uncover stories, demand that accountability that you mentioned. And it's a type of work that's oftentimes hardest to do with minimal resources. And I guess, you know, beyond just, you know, not even performing that basic watchdog function, is that ability to dig even deeper and do those more investigative pieces, is there a danger that that's really being lost here as a lot of these organizations are kind of forced to rely on aggregated stories or the kind of low-hanging fruit coverage of let's just go to that presser or let's just call on that press release we got?
Sure. So, I mean, yes, as you reduce staff, you absolutely are cutting back your eyes and ears. You're therefore cutting back the tips that are going to naturally gravitate from a reporter who is covering a beat and sees something that seems awkward and follows up on it. If you don't have the reporter covering the beat, it is much more haphazard in terms of whether that will be spotted. That said, I do think that there's an increasing number of startups that are trying to make a difference in this space. You have nonprofits at the local and national level that weren't there years ago. You have public broadcasting, which is in many communities stepping up to help fill this void. You have collaborations across newsrooms. It used to be only competition, but I think now news organizations realize that to survive, you have to talk to one another and you have to be willing to collaborate on investigative stories. So those are all signs of hope. I think they're born of necessity, but everybody recognizes that this is critical. And I think they may be willing to pare back some of the things that they may deem extraneous, cultural coverage or some sports coverage or movie reviews, theater reviews. Those are not extraneous. They're important, and communities, I think, rely on news organizations for that. But I think as news organizations are forced to make decisions on what to cover and what not to cover, they're more likely to, I think, choose accountability reporting over some of those other areas.
You mentioned ProPublica's work in this area. You're now overseeing ProPublica's local reporting network. Can you tell us a little bit about what that does and how it can help address some of these issues, especially when it comes to investigative accountability reporting?
Sure. So our local reporting network provides grants to local news organizations to enable a reporter to spend a full year working on a single project. We pay their salary and a stipend for benefits for that reporter. And then we provide a whole bunch of support on our side to help ensure that those projects are what they envisioned and even more. So we provide help with data. We provide help with research, with community engagement, which is an area of our strength. We provide even help with design and photography, so and audience, and so many areas that are ProPublica's strengths. We have a staff on our on ProPublica staff who focus on working with our local partners, and that has worked really, really well. We've enabled stories that have created major changes in communities at the local level, at the state level. I think by shining the light together, we've demonstrated that it's not that local reporters lack the ideas, it's that sometimes they just lack the resources to pursue their ideas.
You mentioned that possibility and what the local reporting network at ProPublica does. You also mentioned collaborations. Are there some other ways that this type of original and investigative reporting on the local level can be bolstered or encouraged?
Well, I think right now there's a lot of experimentation as well. So I think not only collaboration, but experimentation. People are thinking through new ways of doing this. Some journalists are crowdfunding particular projects and trying to raise money for a particular project. ProPublica recently partnered up with the Texas Tribune, which is a really powerful policy and politics brand. And Texas is a nonprofit like we are. And we've jointly opened a unit, an investigative unit together that is for both of our news organizations. And it's really doing unbelievable sort of accountability reporting right out of the gate. So those are some of the ways in which you start to see some experimentation.
One of the other issues that local news faces is its makeup, which in many places is largely male and largely white, especially in leadership roles. Can you talk a little bit about the impact that has on local news and information and how that can impact the local communities that are accessing that news and information?
Sure. Well, first, you know, my own privilege is I am a white male, so I speak from the position that you're talking about, but I also speak recognizing just how important it is to have a diverse set of voices in the newsroom, and not just diverse for the sake of diversity, but diverse because people of different backgrounds have had different experiences in their backgrounds and see what needs to be investigated with different lenses on. And there's a strength in having multiple perspectives and not sort of one prototypical way of looking at the world. So I think from our newsroom, we have we focus on diversity, but not just because it's lately a catchword. We are focusing on it from, you know, high school to professional journalism, in the sense that we recognize that right at the start of the pipeline, you have to build youngsters who are interested in journalism. And give folks opportunities in high school, in college, when they graduate from college, that not everybody is ready at a young age to even recognize that they want to be an investigative reporter. And frankly, you know, when you have a number of years of experience, there are lots of news organizations that are interested right now in simply increasing the share of journalists of color. And so that is not what this is about. It truly is recognizing that you are stronger for having a diversity of voices and a diversity of perspectives. And that's what this is about.
And it's a better chance that you'll actually be reflecting your community if you have that kind of diversity within your own newsroom.
Absolutely. And we see that in our local reporting network, that the diversity of perspectives that people bring have led to unbelievable stories.
We've talked about some of these issues for local news, but I guess there's also some good news here when you look at some of the surveys that are done. People still tend to trust their local news outlets. How important is that, and how important is it that local news organizations find ways to build on that trust and build a sense of place or community that involves them?
Trust is really important. Without trust, what is your coin of the realm? If what you produce is doubted, it is you lose your ability for people to take you seriously, for you to have impact when you point out things that are broken potentially. So trust is incredibly important. Trust happens from a lot of different ways. Trust happens from writing about things in an accurate way. Trust happens by showing that you are interested in hearing from a wide array of voices, diverse voices, voices from multiple perspectives of a story. Trust happens by being inclusive, by letting folks have a way of interacting with you, by engaging with the community. That's one thing that I think ProPublica takes very seriously, is that we try to build communities around our stories and our projects. And it's not just a community in which we are seeking to extract something from the community as an information, but something where we attempt to give back to the community as well, which is information and resources and guides and connections. And when you are able to sort of approach it from both of those perspectives, a community can help you get information, and you can help the community by sharing information with them. That builds a level of trust, and people recognize that, and they don't feel like they're being used for the purpose of a story.
I was going to say that trust it can be really important at the local level, because you mentioned a little bit earlier, when you don't have reporters on beats who are kind of cultivating sources and cultivating tips, having that trust to find perhaps tips and sources elsewhere in an era where access can be really difficult, that politicians and others make it a little bit harder for reporters to gain the access they need. Even FOIA is not as easy, particularly for small organizations that don't maybe have money to pay for a FOIA request. Having that trust to create maybe avenues of access that you need to do stories seems also it's really important at this time.
Yeah, I mean, just to give you an example, back in 2018, during our first year of the LRN, we partnered with WMFE, which is a public radio station in Orlando, and they did a project about PTSD and first responders, particularly after the Pulse nightclub shooting in Orlando. And this was a really resonant issue locally, but first responders, police, firefighters aren't always the most trusting of media, right? And so we had to build trust within that community. And I think we did so by speaking to the community about the questions we wanted to ask, by talking to experts about the resources that we could provide, by listening, right? By being truthful and trustworthy in the way in which we shared their information. And I think that was an incredibly successful project. We, in the end, heard from hundreds of first responders who shared their experiences dealing with PTSD, and that really informed our reporting.
Given all that we've talked about so far, what do you see as the outlook for local news? What is likely the best case scenario and the worst case scenario as you see it moving forward?
Well, I think if our economy doesn't pick up and worsens, that is a huge threat to local news. We've already seen pretty severe and drastic decreases in advertising. not just in light of the coronavirus, but prior to that. I think those have accelerated as advertisers and businesses pare back their own spending. That is a huge threat to local news. I also think another threat is the polarization of our society. The more we become polarized and less trusting in institutions, the media is an institution, and it becomes harder for local news organizations to regain, you know, that trust. So I think those are two factors. Obviously, if the economy doesn't pick up, that's going to pose an additional threat. And I think, you know, some local news, some journalists have seen their organizations purchased by hedge funds or funds in which there is a strong involvement of hedge funds. Those companies often seek to keep a very close eye on their profit margins, and some of them have seen drastic effects in the number of journalists on their staff. You can't do more with less. You can't do the same with less. You do less with less. And at a certain point, your audience is going to say, why am I subscribing? And it is not all bleak, though, because I do think, like I said, there are a lot of experiments going on. And some of those may supplant the traditional source of news. That is not necessarily a horrible thing. What's important is that communities have places they can trust to get information about what's happening in their communities.
Charlie, we'd like to end our podcast by asking each of our guests, so where do you get your news on a daily basis? What are your go-to or favorite news sources?
Oh, gosh. I mean, I subscribe to a bunch of news organizations. I subscribe to the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal. I subscribe to my local newspaper, the Star-Ledger, which is in Newark, New Jersey. I have online subscriptions to the LA Times and the Washington Post and the Atlantic. I regularly go to organizations like the Houston Chronicle and the Dallas Morning News, which I think, you know, are terrific and doing just a yeoman's job. And also, as the person who oversees our local reporting network, I have gained such an appreciation for the news organizations across the country, whether it's the Anchorage Daily News in Alaska, MLK 50, which is an online nonprofit news organization in Memphis. I love the folks at the Publix Radio, which is a public radio station in Providence, Rhode Island. I really like AL.com in Birmingham, Alabama. So I think when you are sort of looking around, it's pretty impressive what you see and the great array of news that's available out there.
Charlie Ornstein, Deputy Managing Editor for ProPublica. We thank you so much for joining us on the A Matter of Facts podcast. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the latest edition of the A Matter of Facts podcast. The A Matter of Facts podcasts are available at DelawarePublic.org and DEHumanities.org. A Matter of Facts is brought to you by Delaware Humanities, a state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Its mission is to engage, educate, and inspire all Delawareans through cultural programming. We thank the Andrew W. Mellon Foundation for its generous support of this initiative and the Pulitzer Prizes for its partnership. A Matter of Facts is produced by Delaware Public Media. And that's all we have time for on this week's edition of The Green. The stories, interviews, and podcasts you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. And remember, you can also check out The Green via podcast at our website, on Apple Podcasts, and on the NPR One app. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page, on Twitter, at TheGreenDE, or by emailing us at TheGreen@DelawarePublic.org. Support for The Green comes in part from the Delaware Alliance for Nonprofit Advancement. As the leader of the nonprofit sector, Dana is committed to strengthening, enhancing, and advancing Delaware nonprofits through low-cost training, consulting, research, and advocacy support for nonprofit leaders and board directors. Thanks to those who helped make today's show possible, Sierra Fisher and Kyle Parks with Delaware Humanities, who helped produce the A Matter of Facts podcast, contributor Larry Nagengast, and Delaware Public Media's Sophia Schmidt. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Burns saying thanks for joining us this week, and we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground.